Hey, I'm Sean, host of The Gray Area. For the show this week, I talked to Sebastian Younger, the writer, filmmaker, and author of the book In My Time of Dying. We talk about his own near-death experience and how it shook up his worldview and really changed how he thought about everything. This week's episode is audio only, but we'll be back on video next week. Hope you enjoy.
What happens when we die? I've always been a cold, hard materialist on this one. Our brain shuts down, consciousness fades away, and the lights go out. And beyond that, what else is there to say? I had no experience of life before I was born, and I expect to have no experience of life after I die. As best I can tell, that's the most reasonable assumption we can make about death. But most reasonable does not mean definitely true. There's the conventional view taken by major religions that the shape of your afterlife depends on the quality of your actual life. I have my issues with that, but it's a widely held belief. The point, in any case, is that this is one of the oldest questions we have. Which means there are all sorts of theories about how consciousness, in some form, might survive the death of the body. However unlikely these possibilities might be, they're not impossible. And if they're not impossible, how seriously should we take them? I'm Sean Illing, and this is The Gray Area. Today's guest is Sebastian Younger. He's a former war reporter, a documentarian, and the author of several books, including his most recent one called In My Time of Dying. Younger's not the religious or superstitious type. He's a self-described atheist and a science-minded rationalist. And I suspect he would have given a very confident response to that question about life after death, until the day he almost died. An experience that didn't necessarily transform his worldview, but it did shake it up. I wouldn't say my answer to the "what happens when we die" question is all that different after reading the book, but I would say that I'm less certain about it. And that's sort of the point. Sebastian Younger, welcome to the show.
Very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the strangeness of your near-death experience, can you just describe what happened to you the day you almost died? Just to set the scene here a little bit.
Yeah, so I was 58 years old. I've been a lifelong athlete. My health is like very good. And so it never occurred to me that I would have a sudden medical issue that would send me to the ER or kill me, you know, sort of drop me in my boots, as it were. So I just had no thoughts about like that about myself. And so one afternoon, it was during COVID, my family and I were living in a house in the woods in Massachusetts that has no cell phone coverage. It's at the end of a dead-end dirt road. On their property is a cabin, no electricity or anything like that. And we went out there to spend a couple of hours. And literally in mid-sentence, I felt this sort of bolt of pain in my abdomen. And I couldn't make it go away. I sort of twisted and turned. I thought it was indigestion. And I stood up and almost fell over. And so I sat back down. I said to my wife, I'm going to need help. I don't know what's wrong. I've never felt anything like this. What was happening, I later found out, was that I had an undiagnosed aneurysm in my pancreatic artery, and one of several arteries that go through to the pancreas. And one of them had a bulge in it from a weak spot. And aneurysms are widow makers. I mean, they're really, really deadly, particularly in the abdomen, because it's hard for the doctors to find them. And if you're stabbed in the stomach and an artery is severed, the doctors sort of know where to put their finger, as it were, to plug the leak. But if it's just internal hemorrhage, your abdomen's basically a big bowl of spaghetti. It's very, very hard to find it. So I was losing probably a pint of blood every 10 or 15 minutes. And, you know, there's like 10 pints in the human body, 10 or 12 pints. So you can do the math. And I was a 1 hour drive from the nearest hospital. I was a human hourglass, basically. So by the time they got me there, I'd probably lost 2/3 of my blood. My blood pressure was 60 over 40. And I was in end stage hemorrhagic shock. I was probably 10 minutes from dead, but I was still conscious. Blessedly, I had no idea that I was dying. I was enormously confused by what was happening, and I had no clue about the seriousness of it.
60 over 40. My God, how were you even still alive at that point?
That's sort of where you cross over into a place where you can't recover from, even if you get a massive blood transfusion, which I got. I mean, if you need that much blood, receiving that much blood causes other problems that can also kill you. So you can die in the hospital from blood loss with plenty of blood in your veins, because other things happen chemically in your bloodstream that will kill you. It's deadly. And I was sort of right on the cusp of when that could reasonably have started to happen. And I'd actually had sort of intermittent pain in my abdomen for about 6 months, which, just being an idiot dude, I just ignored, right? And, you know, it was bad enough to make me sit down at times. I was like, oh, what's that? And then it would go away and I'd forget about it. And that was probably the aneurysm getting to a kind of critical point where it was starting to leak a little bit, starting to bleed a little bit or something, you know. And if I'd gone to the doctor, I could have avoided a lot of drama, but I didn't.
Yeah, note to everyone in the audience, if you know something's wrong with your body, don't fuck around. Go get it checked out.
Yeah, I mean, pain's an indicator, and persistent pain's an indicator. And frankly, your unconscious mind, listen, I'm an atheist, I'm a rationalist, I'm an anti-mystic, I hate woo-woo stuff. My dad was a physicist and an atheist, just like that's who I am. But the unconscious mind actually has access to a lot of information about the body. It communicates with your conscious mind in these strange signals and intuitions and feelings. And one of the stranger things about this was the first time I felt this pain in my abdomen, I had this bizarre thought. I thought, huh, that's the kind of pain where you later find out, oh my God, I have terminal cancer.
Right.
Like I immediately thought this was a mortal threat and then immediately dismissed it as, you know, listen, you just have a pain in your abdomen. Like, don't worry about it.
And what was the survival rate for your condition that day?
The survival rate is as low as 30%. Mm. But I assume that that's for a reasonable transport time to the hospital. It took me 90 minutes to get to a doctor. My survival chances were extremely low.
Mm. The brain does such strange things in these moments. I mean, you knew on some level that something was really wrong here. But even at the hospital, you write about not having any grand thoughts about life or mortality or even about your family. You wrote, I had all the introspection of a gut shot coyote, which is a great line, but what the hell is that about? You think it's just a kind of defense mechanism in the brain, or is it just plain old-fashioned shock?
I was in hemorrhagic shock and deep into hypothermia, which comes with hemorrhagic shock. I was in an enormous amount of pain. So blood in your abdomen outside of your vascular system is extremely irritating to the organs. I was in and out of consciousness, which I didn't know. I mean, if you go in and out of consciousness, you don't know it. You think it's all one stream of consciousness, but actually what drops out is the parts where you're unconscious. You have no idea you're in and out of consciousness. So I didn't know that about the situation. And it was belly pain. And I had this sort of distant thought, you know, it may turn out you're going to wake up in the hospital tomorrow morning with really grim news that you have a tumor in your abdomen. And, you know, I mean, I sort of was aware that that might happen, but I didn't know it was going down right now. Like, I had no idea. And, you know, I had the level of sort of situational awareness that like someone who's really, really drunk might have. And I was an animal, you know, pain turns you into an animal. I was an animal. I was a wounded animal.
So when this happened, if your wife, Barbara, wasn't with you, if you were out running or something like that, you're probably dead right now. And we're not talking. I mean, how much did that thought rack your brain in the aftermath?
Oh, afterwards, I was tormented by that. I mean, any other situation, I mean, traffic jam and the Cross Bronx Expressway, if I was on an airplane, hiking in the woods, running, I mean, anything, like anything. And as it was, I barely made it. Another strange thing that I should mention about the unconscious. So two nights prior at dawn, so about 36 hours before the aneurysm ruptured, I was woken by this terrible dream. A nightmare. And it was that I was dead. Not that I was dying or going to die. I was dead. I was a spirit. And I was looking down on my family and they were grieving. They were sobbing. And I was trying to yell to them and wave my arms like, I'm here. It's okay. I'm right here. It's all right. Everything's okay. And then I was made to understand that I had died. I was beyond their reach and there was no going back. And this was just how it is. And I was headed out into the darkness. And I was so bereft. I was so anguished by this that it woke me up. I mean, I was just like, oh my God, thank God that was just a dream. As a rationalist, I have to sort of think, all right, your unconscious mind has some mechanism of knowing if there's a mortal threat going on. And it doesn't know how to communicate with dumbass up there who's, you know, okay, 6 months of pain. He's still not taking notice. All right, now what do we do? All right, well, let's give him a really bad nightmare, right? Yeah. Oh, he's still not listening? Well, we tried. You know, I feel like the unconscious mind is sort of like a little bit in that place with us.
Mm, yeah, we're about to careen into some potentially woo-woo stuff here. So let me let me pause, back up just a hair, and then we'll ease into it. Because I want to actually get to the near-death experience itself. The way you write about it in the book is so unbelievably vivid. I mean, I really feel like I experienced it just reading it. I mean, there's a moment when the surgeons and the nurses are working on you and they're on your right side. And then on your left side, there's this pit of blackness. It's scary as hell. And your father, who I think has been dead 8 years at this point, appears before you or above you. Tell me about that.
Right. Yeah. So the doctor was busy trying to put a large gauge needle into my jugular vein, you know, through my neck. It sounds a lot worse than it actually is. It didn't particularly hurt, but
it sounds bad.
It sounds bad. Yeah. I mean, I think they numb you with lidocaine. So actually I didn't feel much except a kind of pressure, but at any rate, so they were working on that and seeming to take a long time. And suddenly this black pit opened up underneath me that I was started getting pulled into. You know, again, think of me as extremely drunk, right? Like I'm like, whoa, what's that? Like, it didn't occur to me like black pit. That makes no sense. Like I was like, oh, there's the pit. Like, why am I getting pulled into it? And I didn't know I was dying, but I sort of had this animal sense that if you don't want to go into the infinitely black pit that just opened up underneath you, like that's just a bad idea. And if you get sucked in there, you're probably not coming back. Like that was the feeling I had about it. Yeah. And I started to panic. And that's when my dead father appeared above me in this sort of energy form. It's hard to describe. I can't describe what it was like. I just perceived him. It's not like there was a poster board of him floating above me. It wasn't quite that tangible. And he was communicating this incredible benevolence and love. He's like, listen, you don't have to fight it. You can come with me. I'll take care of you. It's going to be okay. I was horrified. I was like, go with you. You're dead. I'm not going anywhere with you. Like, what are you talking about? Get out of here. Like, I was horrified. And I said to the doctor, because I was conversant, you got to hurry. You're losing me. I'm going right now. And I didn't know where I was going, but I was very clear I was headed out and I did not want to. And I knew he had to hurry.
So you say communicating. What does that mean? Is he actually talking to you? Is it gesturing or just a feeling or is it telepathically or what?
I didn't hear words, right? But his communication to me, I guess you would have to classify it as telepathic. But it was very specific. You don't have to fight this. I'm here. I'll take care of you. You can come with me. Now I'm a rationalist, but I'm a rationalist with questions. Like I'm a rationalist with a serious question of like, what was that? Is it just neurochemistry? I mean, when I woke up the next morning in the ICU and the nurse came in and I was in a lot of distress, I was throwing up blood. I was a freaking mess. I was still not, I could have still died at that point. I mean, I was not out of the woods at all. And the nurse came in and said, wow, congratulations, Mr. Younger, you made it. We almost lost you last night. You almost died. And when she said that, that's when I remembered my father. I was like, oh my God, I saw my father and I saw the pit and it all came rushing back to me.
A rationalist with questions. I love that. That may be my religion. If I have one.
Right.
Given what I know about your dad from this book, that he would appear to you almost like an angel seems like exactly the kind of thing he and you, hyper-rationalist and whatnot, would have dismissed as supernatural nonsense before this.
He would have said, as I'm sort of inclined to say, but not entirely, I think he would have said, well, you know, I'm sure there's sort of neurochemical explanations that it's the brain in distress. there's probably all kinds of things going on neurochemically, high cortisol levels, this and that, like dopamine, whatever. I mean, you know, you can make the brain hallucinate. You can, you know, epileptics have visions. You know, I mean, there's analogous phenomena in life with people. And so I think he probably would have ascribed it to that. And I'm inclined to as well, you know, sort of, except there's one thing that sort of stuck in my mind that the doctors and the rationalists couldn't quite explain. And let me just say, reiterate again, I'm an atheist. Now, I still do not believe in God. Atheist means that you do not believe in God. I do not believe in God. But I do have serious questions about whether we understand the nature of the universe and the physical reality that we inhabit. That there is a serious question. And that's different from God.
There's something you describe in the book that was maybe the most holy shit moment for me. And there are several holy shit moments in this story. So a few days before your dad died of heart failure, you had an intense dream. He was in Boston, you were in New York, but you woke up in the middle of the night as though he was screaming your name from the next room. You look at the clock and it was 3:15 a.m. And then a few hours later, your mom calls, tells you to go to Boston as soon as you can because your dad tried to throw himself out of bed in a panic. And when you asked her what time that happened, she said, 3:15 a.m. I mean, come on, Sebastian, what the hell is that? That's crazy.
It is crazy. And again, the rationalist in me is like, okay, does that prove there's a God? No, not really. It means that humans can communicate in ways that science doesn't understand and even communicate across distance. And there's at the quantum level, at the subatomic level, there actually is instantaneous communication between particles across vast distances, even across the entire universe. And that's known to be true. And we don't know why. We can't explain how that works, but we know that it does work. So if that's possible, can human minds communicate with, quote, telepathy? That seems to be something that almost everyone experiences with people they love. So to me, it stands to reason that it's possible.
Well, you talk to plenty of doctors and scientists about this. You even tried talking to some of your own doctors about your experience. What do they make of it? I'm sure they take you seriously, but how seriously do they take this story and stories like this, near-death experiences, that is?
Well, it depends on the doctor who you're talking to. It depends on the researcher. And there's a whole body of research conducted by doctors and neurobiologists and all kinds of very accomplished, educated people. There's a lot of documentation of what are called NDEs, near-death experiences, and sort of hovering above loved ones, as I did in my dream, or seeing a dead person show up to escort you over the threshold, are very, very common for near NDEs. Now, I didn't know this, so I wasn't projecting something that I knew. So some researchers have concluded that this is sort of verifiable proof that there is some kind of afterlife that we don't understand. And they do use the word afterlife, which is a, you know, of course, on a semantic level is kind of a problem because death is the end of life. So after life, I don't even know what that means. It's clearly not life, but they do come to that conclusion. And then there's a lot of other scientists and doctors like, nonsense, it's neurobiology. We can explain all of this. And after I came home from the hospital, it was not a sort of joyful party. I was enormously traumatized. The fact that I'd almost left my children fatherless was devastating to me. I became very sort of paranoid that now that I sort of looked over the precipice and realized that any moment of any day, you can suddenly find yourself dying in entirely unpredictable ways. Like that really rattled me. And then I got into this other existential bind, which was I started to worry that maybe I had died and that I was a ghost and that I was sort of haunting my family and they couldn't see me. And I just thought they could see me and were interacting with me, but actually I wasn't really there. And I know that sounds totally silly, but it was a real fear. And at one point I went to my wife and I was like, tell me I'm here. They just tell me that I'm, you know, she said, of course you're here. And she sort of reassured me. But in my mind, I'm like, that's exactly what a hallucination would say to you, right? Like I was in a real, very, very difficult place, which is not uncommon for someone who survived something like this. So I started researching, and eventually I tracked down researching NDEs and quantum physics and all this stuff, trying to explain what happened to me. And part of me was kind of rooting that maybe there is an afterlife. Maybe we don't need to be scared of death. You know, like, ooh, wow, these stories are pretty hard to refute. And then I'd read the rationalists and like, I was like, oh well, like, nice try, but this clearly is just nonsense. So I called on some colleagues of my father who were younger than him, who were really fond of my dad. And I invited them for lunch, and I told them what happened to me. And I said, what do you think my dad would have thought of this? And at one point I asked, what would the odds be of my father reappearing above me, reconstituting himself on some level above me as I was dying? Are there odds for such a thing? And he said, well, this is how scientists think, right? He took me totally literally. He was like, all right, well, let's see. And he sort of ran the numbers. He's like, well, I would say probably about 10 to the minus 60.
Very specific.
Very specific. It's a number with one chance and a number that has 60 zeros following it, roughly. I was like, what? What are you talking? How did you come to that number? He said, well, it's roughly the odds of all the oxygen molecules converging in one corner of the room and suffocating us. Their odds are not zero. They're almost infinitely small, but they're roughly, according to statistical mechanics, they're roughly 1 to the minus 60. And so those are the odds of the molecules that made up your father, or the subatomic particles that made up your father, randomly and kind of miraculously having a sort of like reunion in the corner of the room. Like, that's, there are numbers for this. And so at that point, I realized the infinite rationality of the scientific mind.
Yeah, I think when I got to that part of the book, I was reminded that I most definitely do not have the brain of a physicist, for better or worse.
Yeah, for better or worse. You know, that sort of focus of thought makes human relationships hard, because my father missed a lot of the sort of the human element, right? The sort of emotional element. He was a very sweet man, but very distant, and had no idea how to relate to children, or really had sometimes a tough time with adults. So when he appeared above me, it struck me as the most overtly loving, generous, big-hearted thing he'd ever done.
When we get back from the break, what can science tell us about near-death experiences? Stay with us. Support for the show comes from Shopify. Starting a business is all about turning your ideas into reality. And to see it through, you need the right tools. Tools like Shopify. Shopify is a commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world. And they say 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to brands just getting started, like Dr. Sean Illing's Drillings and Fillings, and the gray area soul patch dye for hip cats who want to look as young as they feel. Shopify's design studio lets you build a big, beautiful online store that matches your brand style. You can also use their AI tools to step up your content creation. Plus, you can easily create email and social media campaigns to meet your customers wherever they are. If you're ready to sell, you can be ready for Shopify. You can turn your big business idea into reality with Shopify on your side. You can sign up for your $1 per month trial period and start selling today at shopify.com/Vox. Go to shopify.com/Vox. Shopify.com/Vox. Getting back to the science, I mean, do we really understand what happens in the brain during these experiences? Does science have a firm grasp of this?
Yes and no. I mean, there was a case where a man was dying. I think he'd had a stroke, and they had electrodes attached to his skull to signal different brain activity to know how to treat him. And he passed some point of no return, and the doctor said, okay, it's okay. You can sort of turn the machines off, basically. But the sensors were still in place on his skull.
Yeah.
And so they had the chance to watch what was happening to the brain waves in real time as a person died. And what they found was that in the 30 seconds before and after the moment of death, and of course, death isn't just confined to a single moment, it's a spectrum, but there was a surge in brain activity related to dreaming and memories and all kinds of other things. And so one of the things that might happen when people die is that they experience this sort of flood of sensations from their life. Why would they? who knows? Like, it's hard to come up with a sort of Darwinian reason. Like, how would that be adaptive? The person's dying. It's not a question of survival and procreation. And Darwinism is not concerned with emotional comfort. It doesn't matter in those sort of Darwinian arithmetic. So it's hard to know what to make of that. But they did have one chance to do that.
Science is reductionist by design. And you can study near-death experiences and you can map the neurochemical changes and you can give a purely materialist explanation for them. But do you think it's wise to leave it there? Or do you think there's something just inherently mysterious about this that we just can't quite understand?
At one point, someone said to me, you know, you couldn't explain what happened to you in rational terms. Why didn't you turn to mystical terms? And I said, because rational terms is what an explanation is. And the alternative is a story. Right? And humans use stories to comfort themselves about things they can't explain. I don't choose to use the God story or the afterlife story to comfort myself about the unexplainable, which is like what's going to happen when I die. But let me say that the one thing that really stood out, I mean, I sort of bought all the neurochemical explanations, all of the sort of hard-boiled rationalists, like we're biological beings, when we die, that's it. And the flurry of experiences that dying people have is just the dying brain frantically, you know, bombarding us with signals like what's going on, like stop, like what, you know, that kind of sort of neurological confusion. Except for one thing. And what I don't understand is this, like if you give a room full of people LSD, we know that 100% of those people will have hallucinations. We know why. We know how that works. There's no mystery there. You don't need God to explain that. But they'll all hallucinate different things. Right. And what's strange about dying is that only the dying seem to see the dead. And they do that in societies all around the world and have for ages. I mean, there's many historical accounts of this as well. And the people who aren't dying do not see the dead. And often the dead are unwelcome and they're a shock. It's not some reassuring vision of Aunt Betty, right? I mean, it's just like, Dad, what are you doing here? Or my mother, as she died, she saw her dead brother, who she was not on speaking terms with. And when she saw him, she was horrified. She was like, what's he doing here? And I said, Mom, it's your brother. I just took a guess, right? I said, Mom, it's your brother, George. You have to be nice to him. He's come a long way to see you. And she just frowned and said, we'll see about that. You know, she died a day later. So it's not like these are comforting visions or in projections. And the fact that only the dying see the dead is the one thing that science can't quite explain. It's the one thing that really does make me wonder, you know, maybe we don't understand everything in scientific terms. Maybe there is something missing here that is very significant about how reality works, how life and death work, what consciousness is, and ultimately what the universe is.
Yeah, I don't want to fetishize doubt or make a virtue of doubt, but this is the kind of stuff that just leaves me in that same place, that just the position of, man, I don't really know.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure it's knowable. And that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, some people rush in with stories to fill that gap.
A lot can go wrong there.
Yeah. One of the theories about consciousness, a theory that Schrödinger ascribed to, who was one of the pioneers of quantum physics, is that consciousness is actually suffuses the entire universe. And there's a kind of colossus of consciousness in the universe, which is 93 billion light years wide at the moment, just so that you understand the scale of the universe. And that our individual consciousness is sort of a very, very limited experience of the universal consciousness. It's sort of scaled down to sort of the puny human size. But actually, there is a universal consciousness. And there's a theory called biocentrism that this consciousness completely affects how the universe is constructed physically, that there's a symbiotic relationship between physical reality and consciousness where they actually depend on each other. And you can't prove it, you can't disprove it. It's a fascinating theory. But it's where there, for me, there's a little bit of comfort. Like, no, I do not believe in God, and I certainly don't believe in an afterlife where I, as Sebastian Younger, sort of continue on without the need to eat or sleep, and I can kind of float around talking to all the people I miss. But it's possible that when we die, that the sort of quantum information that involved our identity and our consciousness is reunited with the grand consciousness, the colossus, there is something there that I find a little comforting and scientifically possible, right? It just, we're never going to prove it because I think we just don't have the tools.
And even to say that there's an afterlife, it's not to say that there's a God necessarily. There could be some post-life reality that we just don't understand, or one that's far weirder than we can imagine. But that would not mean that any of our religious stories are true. It would just mean shit's a lot weirder than we thought.
Yeah. I mean, as I say in the book, you know, our understanding of reality might be akin to a dog's understanding of a television set. No concept that what they're watching is a product of the screen and the wider context that produced the screen. I mean, religious people, and I, you know, I have obviously a number of friends who are religious, like when they hear this story of mine, they're very fond of saying, so are you still an atheist? Like, you saw your dead father while you were dying. Are you still an atheist? And of course, my pat little answer is, look, I saw my dad, not God. Like, if I'd seen God, we might have a conversation to have, but I saw my dad. And as you point out, it's entirely possible that there could be some kind of creator God that created biological life in the universe, that when it dies absolutely and completely, and there's no, quote, afterlife. Or there could be a post-death existence at some quantum level that we don't and can't understand in a completely physical universe that has no God. The two things don't require each other, and you could have one or the other or neither or both. It's all possible.
One of the medical paradoxes here is that people who are dying experience near total brain function collapse, and yet their awareness seems to crystallize, which seems impossible on its face. Do scientists have an explanation for this? Is it even a paradox at all, or does it just seem that way to someone on the outside who doesn't understand it?
I don't think anyone knows. You know, ultimately, no one even knows if what we perceive during life is true. I mean, it's known at the quantum level that observing a particle, a subatomic particle, changes its behavior. Now, of course, when you observe something, it's a totally passive act. You're not bombarding it with something, right? You're just watching. If a particle, a photon, is sent through two slits in an impassable barrier and it's unobserved by a conscious mind, it will go through both slits simultaneously. And once you observe it, it's forced to pick one slit. So as the early physicists said, observation creates the reality that's being observed, and then the snake starts to swallow its tail. And it's been proposed that the universe is one massive wave function of all possibilities, of all things, and that the arrival of conscious thought, conscious perception, forced the entire observable universe to collapse into one single thing, which is the universe that we know. The observer creates the reality that was being observed, including the entire universe that the observer inhabits.
I will say this. I mean, if there is a heaven or afterlife, I don't think it's what most people think it is, which is a projection of our earthly wishes, and a rather transparent one at that. But it might be some bizarre quantum reality that I can't even pretend to understand because I don't know the first thing about physics or quantum mechanics, other than that great line from Einstein calling it spooky action at a distance. This is sort of where you land too, right? That reality is just very strange, and who the hell knows what's really going on or what's really possible for that matter.
Yeah. I mean, at the quantum level, things happen that contradict everything we understand about the macroscopic level. So you can't walk through two doorways at the same time. You can't be in two places at once. But at the quantum level, you can. And so that opens the possibility of extremely strange things that are extremely strange in the macroscopic world being absolutely ordinary in the quantum world. But the granddaddy of them all is the universe. The universe came from nothing and expanded from nothing to hundreds of millions of light years across in an amount of time that is too small to measure. So if that's possible, and we know it's possible because it happened. We can prove that it happened. We are proof that it happened. If that's possible, in some ways, what isn't possible? We're just a question of like how limited our brains are, our amazing brains, but how limited are they in what we can perceive and explain?
You use the phrase the other side a lot in the book. And, you know, someone was clinically dead, they glimpsed the other side, and then they came back. I mean, on some level, this is just the only language we have to describe such things, but what is your understanding of the other side as you sit here now? Is it a place? Is it more like an awareness, or is it just neurochemicals detonating in our brains?
Well, I mean, my direct experience of it was a infinitely black, deep pit that would swallow you and never let you back, and where you would become part of the nothingness that's in it. Whatever you want to say about this, I did have a dream where I experienced being dead. Whatever you want to make of that, that I did have that dream. And the experience of that dream, for whatever it's worth, is that I was a spirit. I didn't exist physically, but I existed as a collection of thoughts, and that that entity that was thinking was being pulled away from everything I knew and loved out into the nothingness forever. And there was a sense of the nothingness being an enormous circle that I was going to start sort of like proceeding around, and an infinitely huge circle. There was a sort of circularity to it, a kind of orbit to it. And I was getting pulled into this orbit of nothingness, and it made me panic, right? It was horrified. Like, there are my children, there's my wife. So for me, the other side is nothing. I mean, it's not like, oh, it's the other bank of the river.
Yeah.
You know, as the joke goes, like, how do I get to the other side of the river? You're on the other side. It's not like that. And that's a kind of comforting vision, and it's one that religions seem fond of, but it's not at all how I see it. And, you know, if it were that way, you'd be looking at an eternity of consciousness with no escape, which is its own hell, right? I mean, I could barely get through math class in high school, 50 minutes, right? That felt like an eternity. You want to be conscious for eternity with no way out? I mean, at least with life, if you need a way out, you can kill yourself. There's no way out of an eternity of consciousness. And suppose that includes unbearable pain or grief. Suppose it's unpleasant.
People often talk about the near-death experience as though it's a gift. To get that close to death and survive, the story goes, is supposed to bring clarity and peace or something like that. Do you find this to be true?
It brought an enormous amount of trauma and anxiety and depression afterwards that I eventually worked through. And I mean work. I mean, it was work to climb out of that. The ICU nurse who told me that I'd almost died, she came back an hour later and said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "Not that well." And she said, "Try this. Instead of thinking about it like something scary, think about it like something sacred." And then she walked out. And so, as an atheist, I'm happy to use the word sacred for its other wonderful meanings. You don't need God to understand that some things are sacred. So for me, that word means, what's the information that people need to lead lives with greater dignity and courage and less pain? That's sacred knowledge. So did I come back from that precipice with any sacred knowledge? And it took me a long time to sort of answer that question. And I read about Dostoevsky. He sort of provided the final answer in some ways for me. So when he was a young man, before he was a writer, he was a little bit of a political agitator. And this is in the 1840s during the times of the Tsar and serfdom. And he and his sort of like... his woke brothers were agitating for freeing the serfs. You know, much like in the United States, there was talk about ending slavery. And the Tsar didn't take kindly to the intelligentsia talking about such nonsense. So he threw these kids in jail. But no one thought it was a particularly serious situation, right? And then finally, they were released. And they were sort of put into a wagon. And they assumed they were going to be released to their families after 8 months. And instead, they were driven to a city square and tied to posts, and a firing squad was arrayed against them. And the rifles were leveled and the rifles were cocked, and the men waited for the order to fire. And what happened, we know what Dostoevsky was thinking, because a rider galloped into the square and said, "The Tsar forgives them." It was all theater, but they didn't know that, of course. "The Tsar forgives them. You know, do not stand down. Like, do not kill them." So Dostoevsky, through a character that is widely thought to be a substitute for himself in a book called The Idiot, notices sunlight glinting off a roof and thinks to himself, "In moments, I'm going to join the sunlight. I'll be part of all things." And that if I should survive this somehow, by some miracle, I will treat every moment as an infinity. I'll treat every moment like the miracle that it actually is. And of course, that's a almost Zen appreciation for reality that's impossible to maintain while you're changing the baby's diapers and the smoke alarm's going off because you burned the dinner and blah, blah, blah. Like, of course, we're humans and we get sucked into our drama. But if you can have some awareness at some point that life happens only in moments and that those moments are sacred and miraculous, if you can get there once in a while, if you can understand that the sunlight glinting off the roof, that you're part of it and it's part of you, and one day it's all going to be the same thing, if you can do that, you will have reached a place of real enlightenment. And I think it deepens your life.
You had a great line in the book. You wrote, "It's an open question whether a full and unaverted look at death crushes the human psyche or liberates it." And it really is, isn't it? I mean, we all know that death is inevitable and that it can come on any day. And living in constant contact with that reality is supposed to be motivation for being more present, for living in the moment, as they say. But no matter how hard we think about it, our death remains an abstraction until it arrives. And I just don't know how you can be prepared for that. And I love what your wife, Barbara, says about that in the book, to the effect of that attitude of life where you feel like you're always at risk of losing everything. That doesn't seem to be healthy, to be in that space all the time.
That's the needle we have to thread, is be aware of our mortality, but not taken hostage by that awareness, which is what happened to me in the immediate aftermath of almost dying. So I should say that two of the young men who were with Dostoevsky, by his account, were insane for the rest of their lives. They never psychologically recovered from the shock. Dostoevsky went in another direction. He went towards, you know, a kind of enlightenment.
I don't know. I guess never thinking about death seems as unwise as obsessing over it. So maybe there's some sweet spot in between. That's where we're supposed to toggle.
One of the definitions of consciousness is to be able to imagine yourself in the future. Well, if you can imagine yourself in the future, you're going to have to imagine yourself dead, because that's what the future holds. And once we're neurologically complex enough to have that thought, it would be paralyzing for the puny efforts of our lives if we weren't able to use an enormous amount of denial. So we have this abstract knowledge that, you know, all is for naught, right? And we're going to die. But we have to keep it out of our daily awareness, because otherwise it would demotivate us. It would keep us apathetic and crazy. And so it's a balancing act that the human mind does. And so the trick, I think, in terms of a kind of healthy enlightenment, is to allow in that awareness of death only to the extent where it makes life seem precious, but not to the extent where it makes life seem so fleeting that why bother?
And maybe that's just our fate as finite, painfully self-aware creatures. We live, we keep rolling our boulders up the hill until the lights go out. And as Camus says, we must imagine Sisyphus happy.
Oh, wonderful. I didn't know that quote. That's a wonderful quote.
After one more short break, we talk about how confronting death changes the way you live. Stay with us. You spend so much of your life taking risks, calculated risks, I would say. Now that you've almost died, now that you're a parent, the game has changed. I imagine the calculus for you is much different as well.
Oh, I stopped war reporting after my buddy Tim was killed in 2011. I saw what his death did to everyone who loved him, and I just realized that going off to war suddenly looked like a selfish act, not a noble one. And so I stopped doing it. And then 6 years later, I had my first child, you know, and I'm an older dad, so I feel extremely lucky. Extremely lucky to be a father, and I'm the most risk-averse person you'll ever meet now. I won't cross Houston Street against the walk light. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous.
Being a parent is emancipatory in the sense that you're not living for yourself anymore, which I do believe, I've come to believe, is a happier, more fulfilling existence. But it makes the prospect of death even worse because of what you leave behind, because the people you love need you.
Yeah.
That is what terrifies me. I had a recent scare with a mole, a funky looking mole on my arm, and I was so worried about it. I mean,
yeah.
My wife was like, you're fine. But I was Googling. What does melanoma look like and all this shit? Oh, Bob Marley had a melanoma on his foot. Oh, shit. It can happen to him.
Right.
Those are the thoughts running through my mind. Not that I would cease to be, but that my son would not have a father.
Yeah.
And that is the most terrifying thought I've ever had.
I talked to a fireman, a father of four, I think, a fairly young man who was trapped in a burning building. He couldn't get out. I mean, he was so desperate, it was a brick exterior wall, and he started trying to punch his way through it. He obviously couldn't. And he finally got to a window. There was zero visibility. It was so filled with smoke. And he finally got to a window and threw himself out head first and survived. And another guy didn't survive. But in those terrible moments, he kept thinking, my son's going to grow up without a father. Once you're a parent, like, it's foremost in your mind. And if you're a parent when you're young, you know, that's the point in your life when you're enormously driven by your own desires and curiosity, and juggling that with the responsibilities of parenthood is extremely hard. And frankly, it's pretty easy to resent the obligations, right? I mean, I'm glad I wasn't a parent at 25. I think I would have been a selfish parent.
Same.
Like, I became a parent at 55. And by that point, I didn't interest me anymore. Like, I wanted to be a father. In that sense, as long as I live a long life, it will have been a very good choice for me.
I didn't interest me anymore. That's a good line.
Yeah.
I may have to steal that. There's a beautiful passage at the end of the book that I'd like to read, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Because it feels like an appropriate way to wrap this up. So now I'm quoting you. One might allow the quick thought that it is odd that so many religions, so many dying people, so many ecstatics, and so many quantum physicists believe that death is not a final severing, but an ultimate merging, and that the reality we take to be life is in fact a passing distraction from something so profound, so real, so all-encompassing, that many return to their paltry bodies on the battlefield or hospital gurney, only with great reluctance and a kind of embarrassment. How can I pass up the truth for an illusion? That's the end of the quote.
Yeah.
What I would say to that is that there's something in me that revolts against any ideology that thinks of life itself as an illusion. I mean, this is why I didn't care for Christianity, the religion of my community, when I was younger, because I didn't like the idea that this life is some kind of way station en route to the next life, which is supposed to be the more important life.
Yeah.
But hearing these accounts of NDEs, your account, it gives me pause. You know, I don't know how else to say it. I don't know what to think. I don't know what's true. There's something here, something worth taking seriously. I guess that's all I know. I guess I'll stop there and let you close this out with your own thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I'm a journalist, and I try to keep my biases out of my work, and I do not come to assertions, to conclusions that aren't backed up by fact. So what I found in my research is that there was an extraordinary number of people who, on the threshold of death, like I was, looked back and thought, that's not the real thing. Life's not the real thing. I'm entering the real thing now. And then I was surprised that there were some extremely smart people and non-religious people, like Schrodinger, like the physicists, who had a sort of similar thought. And so I put that in there not because I'm trying to convince anyone of anything, and I don't even know what I believe particularly, but it's good information. It's important. It's interesting information. It either says something profound about the human brain's capacity for self-delusion, or it contains something profound about the nature of physical reality. And I doubt we'll ever know which it is, but it's important to keep both in mind and to take all the information we can from these extraordinary experiences and to take them at face value, to take them literally. Like, these people really did experience this. What does it mean?
I'm going to leave it right there. Once again, the book is called In My Time of Dying. I read it cover to cover in a day. Just a sublime and honest book. I can't recommend it enough. Sebastian Younger, this was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation.
All right, another episode about death. How about that? As you can tell, it's a recent favorite of mine. I love the intensity of it, and I love the honesty. And for a show that prides itself on leaning into the questions and not needing final answers, this one felt pretty on brand. What did you think? You can drop us a line at thegrayarea@vox.com and let us know. And if you don't have time for that, rate, review, subscribe. That stuff really helps, and we appreciate it. This episode was produced by John Ahrens, edited by Jorge Just, engineered by Patrick Boyd, and Alex Overington wrote our theme music. New episodes of The Gray Area drop on Mondays. Listen and subscribe.